down in Rhodesia. Equal rights. Yeah, of course, the birthday of Mr. Peter McIntosh. Peter Tosh today right here. One of his great, great tunes. And there are so many equal rights right here on WUSB Stony Brook. We're going to be talking to Kira Rossler, a legendary bassist of Black Flag and Dose. In just a few moments, we're going to hear a couple of songs from her new record. But let's get Mr. Watt to tell us what we're listening to.
This is Mike Watt from San Pedro, California, for WUSB Stony Brook, home of the Blue Oyster Cult.
Roaming in darkness, clinging to see, and screaming, staying to stay,
brand new track from Kira Rossler from her self-titled debut album, Kira, which drops today. And you guys can, of course, get a hold of that at Kitten Robot Records. That's right, Kitten Robot Records. The link is right on the playlist on the WUSB.FM site. We're going to hear a couple. I'm going to hear another tune. That, of course, The Ghosts, Seasonally Appropriate. That's right. And beautiful playing from Kira, and great songwriting as well. But Kira's going to be talking with us in just a couple of moments. She of the bassist from Black Flag, the bassist of Dose, and, well, one of two bassists from Dose. And, yeah, we're going to be chatting in just a few minutes, as we have before. Here's another track from the brand new record, Kira, right here on WUSB, Stony Brook.
Outside, walking away,
And that was Avoiding from the brand new record Kira by Kira Rossler, and a spectacular new record that sounds as Kira's records have in over time, really spectacular, and songwriting is sharp. And we're going to get into all of these things, and we are lucky enough right now to have Kira Rossler on the air with us on Finn's Revolution. Kira, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me again, Finn.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk to you and to hear your music, and and you're playing, and you're always going in interesting directions, and the kind of directions I really love, and so it's always a moving thing to hear and speak to you. So it's very happy to have you on. Yeah. First of all, let's talk about something not quite as necessarily deep. Maybe it is, but let's talk about your album cover for the new album, Kira. that's your dog, or what's the story going on here?
So the record sort of tells a story,
right?
And it's a story of love, and it's a story of loss. And that picture is a drawing that an amazing artist did for me of my dog, who's no longer with me. Mm. And his name was Hombrito, Hombrito, little man. And I just love the portrait. The guy did an amazing job. His name is Fred Ahern. And I got that portrait given to me by my husband the Christmas after we lost Hombrito. So it's always had a lot of meaning for me. And the record, you know, tells this story, which he's very much a part of. So to me, there was no doubt of what the cover should look like.
Yeah, it's really quite it's a moving cover. And when you hear the music, initially it's a little. I just want to tell you as an admirer and a fan, it's a little disconcerting initially, and then you. Well, I'm serious, you know. And
I'm not surprised. It's weird ass music.
Right. No, it's the music with the picture, you know. So yeah. It's the combination of the things.
Finn, let me tell you something. on the flip side of the CD, which is now currently just available on CD, will eventually, I think, press vinyl. On the flip side, the frame is empty, and I'm there with my bass. So it sort of completes the story when you turn it over.
Well, there you go. It's a and of course our attachment to our animals, and we say our animals, but they're our family, and
right.
That is absolutely the case. So I just personally having experienced, you know, as we all have, loss of pets, and I always take the animal loss sometimes, and I sometimes hate to say this, but more seriously than the human loss sometimes.
Well, I don't hate to say it. I mean, I think that for me anyway, I mean, I don't have kids, you know, so
right.
this dog particularly, who I raised from a very young puppy, you know, they become that thing that you're responsible for, that you're nurturing. And there's something about that kind of relationship, which, of course, connects you in a different sort of way than we connect to most of the people in our lives. Plus, they're there, you know, in our home, right close. So the emptiness when they're gone. I mean, I think that it's not that strange that we build that bond of unconditional love with them in a way that is a little separate from how we connect with people.
Yeah, and they also offer almost universally unconditional love as well, and it's quite
right.
quite the phenomenon of you know, I don't know what it's all about, but biology, evolution, whatever the case is that binds dogs specifically to us, although cats have the same relationship
sure.
with many people, as do other animals. But,
sure, I don't think it's specific to dogs. It's a matter of what you yourself connects with. That's one of the things, in a way, that I thought, even though this record may touch on a subject that isn't something everybody's connected to, but love and loss, these are fundamental feelings we've all had. And I hoped to, you know, capture the emotions and that the listener could maybe, you know, connect to something in their lives that, you know, ties in with that kind of emotion.
Yeah, I think it's a very, I'd like to say a very human thing, but it's a, I think it's a very natural thing.
Yeah.
To have those feelings and emotions about all of this. And I think you've captured it beautifully. And this is also a record where you have delved lyrically more into things than you ever have, obviously, I think.
Yeah,
and do you want to talk about that process as far as, because you haven't always been, you know, you've been a musician in a project, which is also lyrical in many ways, of course, but actual concrete lyrics, this is like a big beautiful step, don't you think?
Well, I mean, I've always written songs,
right.
and I definitely think of myself as a bass player who sings, not a singer, but. I wrote lyrics for the Minutemen. I wrote lyrics for Firehose. So I have been known to sit down and try to put things in writing. But the thing about my own music that, you know, happens alone in my room, if you will, is that there's a chance to, you know, really dig into something that, you know, when you're in a group, it's not exactly a democracy, right? The songwriter tends to be, you know, the driving force. And sometimes we're just supportive team members trying to help make their vision happen, you know, and this record, you know, becomes the exception where I get to really be the songwriter. And it really is sort of my band, if you will. And that means taking the lead in terms of the creative stuff. So with the lyrics particularly, I would say many times the song starts on the bass. In other words, there's a feeling. Mm. And then I the bass is so natural for me as a way of expressing myself. And that the lyrics and the, more specifically the melody and the rhythm of singing the lyrics have to happen when there starts to have a musical structure to work with. So the bass is basically very much the tool by which I carve out a structure, and then, you know, the lyrics get molded and sometimes written after. I have a structure, and I've been known to literally just have a phrase go into the song, start the song, and literally start recording on the mic, not even sure what the lyrics will be in some cases. So some of them are written quite late in the process, and once in a while I sit down and sort of write a poem first, you know, just because I'm feeling something and I have something to say. But my bass has just been the part, you know, this part of me that helps me express myself for so long that it's almost easiest to start there.
It's very interesting because it's if you're saying you're starting with the bass, clearly because the lyrics and the bass are so closely tied in these songs, in all your stuff, but I mean especially here, you can really the emotion of each piece is they're very tied together musically and lyrically, and it's obviously one is influencing each other, but I mean it's just it's beautifully done. It's like a seamless thing, you know.
Thank you. Well, it's you know, that's what happens in my room as the bass and the singing, and then I send my songs sometimes to a close friend of mine, Glenn Brown, who's an amazing guitar player and has added some beautiful piece parts in the record. And then I have a drummer friend who's also has some kind of strange ability to play drums without infringing on the sort of delicacy of the music. And so I've been lucky to meet these people and have opportunity to as you can imagine, I mean the spaces and the songs are everything to me, and so everybody I play with, you know, or adds anything has to be sort of delicate and or be edited out depending on what happens, you know. So I'm lucky, and my brother, of course, at Kitten Robot Studio is sort of helps me in the end figure out, is anything else needed? And the answer is often no, but sometimes we add another element. And he helps me, you know, to polish, do some final polishing on it. So that's an important part of the process. But as you say, the intertwining basses and voice are so much the sort of first part for me. And being a bass player, of course, my lyrics are rhythmically aware. My singing parts, you know, tend to be very rhythmically aware too, because you know, part of the rhythm section, even when I'm playing by myself.
Well, that's yeah, and it is that delicacy. And your playing has been like this for a very long time. In fact, even when you were in Black Flag, you brought about all these little melodic lines that people wouldn't have thought would have wound up there prior to your arrival.
And frankly, if all of that was written by Greg, I was very much a team member and not a creative force in Black Flag. And he generally wrote those lines that you're talking about. He and then had me play them so that he could, you know, explore and solo, and my job was to hold down the fort. So it wasn't a creative time. It was a physically challenging time. And it was an opportunity to be a team member, which I think is a very valuable exercise. I certainly, you know, have no regrets about that. But that's very much what's happening in that band, is the writing is happening for Greg in his room, so to speak. And then, you know, he's bringing together the ideas, and we're there to execute them, you know.
Right. But I think your attack is very distinctive, and it's not just the lines. You may not hear that, but
I mean, they did hire me for, I mean, you know, they did invite me to join the band. So there was something there, and yeah. I do appreciate that. And I do, you know, I have been playing bass longer than I've been a woman. So it is, I express myself, as I keep saying, with my bass. So I don't disagree with you. I just wanted to be clear that the creation of those lines was, in that case, wasn't mine. It was really in Dose where I got to start exploring the, you know, how to make basses tell the whole story.
Well, okay, so let's just cover a little bit about Black Flag first for those who are not familiar with your role in the band. You were there from like 83 to like 86, maybe?
95, end of 85, yeah.
Okay, and you put on some great shows with them. That's when I actually first saw Black Flag with you in the band. Mm-hmm. You brought quite a presence to the band. And what was it like? I mean, it's kind of crazy because it's always, when people ask you what it was like, and you know, you're like, it was just my life, you know. But it's like you were at the epicenter of a lot of stuff happening there in the early '80s on that scene. And do you want to talk a little about what that felt like, or how you dealt with it?
Well, I mean, before I was in Black Flag, I was already, you know, sort of playing in bands and being a punker, and you know, so, and of course I knew of Black Flag. I saw all the iterations of Black Flag before I joined the band. So I kind of knew what I was getting into in terms of the commitment level and the word isn't quite right, but I keep using this sort of word professional, because the you know, they took it seriously in a way that a lot of other bands were doing it more for fun, and that didn't feel like, really, we were about something a little bit more serious and focused and all in. So really, once I joined, it was sort of like, I don't know, you know, training for the Olympics or enlisting in the army. It was sort of like, just do what you're told, just give everything that you have to the furtherance of this thing you're doing. And I wasn't paying that much attention about what was going on sort of around, you know. I was I was still at UCLA, so I was studying applied math, and that took a lot of energy. And I was going to practice and practicing a lot of hours and then touring. And, you know, so in a way, my world got very small. And I was just trying to, you know, hold up my end of this pretty intense bargain.
Did you feel at the time for yourself that you were trading something off for that you were missing out on?
No, I mean, once in a while, I think any of us who have toured have had this feeling where you feel like your life is going on without you when you're on tour. Mm. Sometimes, you know, you call home and it feels like things are sort of happening without you. But no, I mean, it's just what is. Like you said, you have a full-time job in a way, and you're just doing what you have to do to be good at what you're being asked to do, and there's not really any room for anything else. I told them I had to finish school, and that was going to be part of the equation. But aside from that, you kind of have to let other things fall by the wayside. And that's really, you know, that is the story of most of my life. You have to, you know, yes, you have to have a balancing act, and you have to figure out what the important things are, but you can't necessarily do all of the things you might do if there were more than 24 hours in a day. You have to decide what's important, right? And we all go through that. And that was, then it was just a very narrow focus. It had to be.
How did Black Flag end for you?
Oh, they kicked me out? you mean that?
Yes, that.
So yeah, I mean, we were on a long tour in 1985. It was a 4-month tour, and I actually called home. I spoke to Mike Watt. Actually, I called home and spoke to him, and I found out that they were scheduling a tour, which was going to be during my last quarter at UCLA during the fall. So I was pretty clear on what that meant.
Right.
So I kind of knew that they were going to ask me to leave before they did. And I had to finish up the tour and keep my mouth shut because it didn't, you know, drama was definitely not encouraged. And then, you know, pretty much pretty shortly after we were finished with the tour, they asked me to leave, and I, you know, I said, okay, I'm taking this, and thanks and bye.
Right, but you were mentally prepared because you knew it was coming.
Yeah, it didn't hurt that I kind of knew it was coming. It wasn't easy, obviously, to do the tours, and I think I probably shed a tear the last gig, knowing it was the last gig, but yeah, in some ways, I'm like that. Change is hard, I think, for a lot of us. So any kind of preparation helps.
Yeah, yeah, and you set your parameters, which was great, because those are your personal guidelines, and that's how you set your parameters and what you would do and what you wouldn't do, and with your own career and your own schooling, etc. And that was fantastic that you were yourself and you held to your game, you know?
Yeah, I've had to be pretty disciplined in that, you know, to do what I do, Black Flag, you had to be pretty disciplined. And that meant also being pretty disciplined about, you know, holding on to what was important and then moving on from there and, you know, finishing my schooling. And then because I wasn't in a band that was, you know, that active, I had to get a job like everybody else when they finished college. You know?
And we're going to talk about some of your other jobs in a moment. But first, let's hear something else from your career. It can be from the new record, Kira. And we are talking, by the way, with Kira Rossler and about her new record, Kira. And it's quite the amazing, beautiful record, as would be predicted by me. And it's on Kitten Robot Records, and we're going to get to the availability of it shortly. And, of course, you guys can hear the podcast of this tomorrow evening from Finn's Revolution on WUSB. But Kira, let's pick something to hear for this little break here. What would you like to hear?
Oh, something from my
Something, well, you can pick anything you'd like, but preferably something with you on it. You know, okay, that would be okay. Nice.
All right, that clarifies things. No okay. wonder you were so confident. All right, I'm going to go with, do you have the Till the Blood Ran from Dose handy?
We absolutely do. Okay. So we're gonna hear something from Dose, who we're going to be talking about in 1 minute. Right now, we'll be right back with Kira Rossler right here on Finn's Revolution on WUSB Stony Brook. Till the Blood Flows by Dose right here on Finn's Revolution on WUSB Stony Brook. And we'll continue our conversation with Kira Rossler, whose new record, Kira, is just out. And we're going to talk about how to get your hands on that very shortly. But Dose, one of my favorite projects with two of my favorite musicians, Mr. Mike Watt, of course, and Miss Kira Rossler. And Kira, tell us a little how Dose came together with Mike.
Well, in I would say, let's see, end of 85. I was visiting my mom actually when I got the call that that Dee Boone had been killed in a car accident, and I was dating Mike at the time, but I wasn't there, and of course. You know, when he called and he told me this, I knew exactly the impact. This was his closest friend as well as his livelihood and his creative outlet and everything, you know, just gone. And I was scared for him, you know, that he would potentially stop playing. So really, it started just with me spending time with him in his room as he was you know, somewhat in a delicate state, as would be expected, and trying to get him to just play, just jam. I had also developed some bedtime stories with my nephews where I read the bedtime stories, and I overdubbed bass guitars, and this was for them to maybe listen to as they tried to get to sleep. Mm. And so I had done these intertwining bass lines on these, and I could bring some of that into Mike to say, hey, let's jam around this, and we did some other jams, and it became, I don't know, at a certain point it was like, well, if we're gonna do something, I'm gonna have two basses, we can't have anything else. I mean, we're pretty bass, you know, forward, if you will. Like, it was like we didn't have any concerns about needing to have anyone else involved if there was going to be the two basses. So that part was easy to decide. And then actually I moved to Connecticut to get my first job out of UCLA. We sent tapes back and forth and started to write the first record or hone the first record, some of which comes out of some of the story tapes. The Rabbit and the Porcupine, you know, is a bedtime story that I, you know, I put music, of course, trying to capture the story a little bit. And then that became a Doe song. And we developed this set of songs, and I flew home from Connecticut to record the first record. So that's sort of how it got started.
Okay. And obviously you guys spent, shall we say, more time together after that point. And both working on different things, I would imagine, as Watt was, you were, and doing your things, but continuing to come together over time to do the Dose project. And it's been, how many records now has Dose put out? Four? Five?
Four, really. I mean, we did, because we did,
put
out one called Uno con Dos, which actually had the first record and the second EP on one CD. So Numero Cuatro was the most recent one. And so they were numbered accordingly, so it's easy to count. So there's really four records, and you know, there was a lot of time in between. I mean, writing Dose songs is extremely complicated. It's the whole thing, really, is the writing of the song. And mm-hmm. also, as you mentioned, I mean, Mike was doing other things. He was very busy. I was working a full-time job. So everything, you know, went pretty slowly in terms of records coming out. So this was over the course of, you know, 30 years that these four records came out.
Right. And in the beginning, of course, Firehose was starting and all that, which you also participated in. They were full on and doing a lot of work. And you know, you were part of that, too. And what was that first job that you were
doing? I was a computer programmer at Yale University first for a year, and then I came home and I was a computer programmer at my at a job at a Culver City company, and I did computer programming for about 11 years.
Okay, and did you enjoy that work?
I enjoyed the work. The corporate life was difficult. I mean, I felt, as you can imagine, a little bit like a square peg trying to go into a round hole. You know, I felt awkward and like an outsider and like I didn't know how to play the game. I tried to overcompensate with just being a really hard worker and trying to be very skilled, because that would offset a little bit of my quirky personality. But it was a struggle, you know, to sort of fit into the corporate world. And so it always felt a little not me, if you will. Not so much the work, but the environment.
Okay, yeah. Well, the corporate environment. It's right. Yeah. It's not conducive for human beings, period, I don't think. But
well, you know, I actually, what I think is, if you somewhat just want to, you know, punch a time clock and go in, do your hours and leave, it's not bad. You can be kind of invisible and be a cog in the wheel, and it's okay. But if But for me, you know, I'm going to spend that much time at something, you know, it's hard to be, feel that invisible.
Right.
So I think there's a, you know, there's certainly a place for that in the sense of, like I said, if like if you're a parent or something and your life is really outside of work and you're just trying to kind of go and do your thing and leave and not have to bring it home with you, you know, there's some advantages to the corporate life. It just didn't suit me.
Yeah. And of course, you have found your way into some film dialogue editing and won some big awards for it.
Yeah, I was lucky that I met a guy who was doing sound for a student film, and I played bass on this because my brother was composing the music for it, and he was doing this, and it sort of clicked. It was like, oh, wow, this incorporates computers and incorporates kind of my sound type sensibilities, and I twisted his arm and got him to hire me, and then I answered phones and did admin stuff, and then I realized that there was kind of this opening, like the guys preferred doing, you know, explosions and car crashes and stuff and guns, and the dialogue was less appealing a lot to the people, you know, there was this sort of niche, so I jumped in and learned that skill, and it does turn out to be a little female biased in the dialogue arena in my industry, and I found that all the way through the industry, there is this sort of skew towards female dialogue editors. There are a lot of guys too, but percentage wise, it's not equal. I'd say there's more women and there's very talented women in that area, much less in sound effects. So I fell into something that made a certain amount of sense, and I was very lucky. People hired me. I got on some shows, and what happens in this industry, like I'm sure several that are more driven by freelance work, right, is that you start to build somewhat of a reputation, and I'm lucky enough to be at a place where people kind of know who I am, and when they need someone, you know, they invite me. So I got invited in to do some really amazing projects like Fury Road, you know, Mad Max Fury Road and Joker and Game of Thrones. You know, I got to do some stuff that was some amazing content, you know, which I always say I can do great work on a movie that isn't good. Like, I don't feel like my success depends on the quality of what I work on, but it's a pleasure to work on something that you actually think is an amazing piece of work too. So I've been really lucky.
Yeah. And actually the reason I'm specifically bringing that job up is because on this record, it sounds like, you know, the writing is crafted in such a way. I hate to sound cliche, you know. Hey, she's a dialogue editor, and the dialogue is great in these songs, but it really is, and it does sound like things are carefully crafted. You know, did you find yourself? I'm going to use the word. Did you find yourself editing yourself to this music a lot?
You know, dialogue editing is not a particularly creative thing. It is much more like a puzzle, and how many problems can I fix? You know, it's more like that, and I appreciate that kind of work. It's not particularly creative. That being said, because I'm a functional editor using Pro Tools, which is the tool I use to do my work, I can repair things or fix things in the music tracks, just like I can in the dialogue tracks. And I won't say that I haven't been known to fix mistakes, as opposed to in the old days when you're on tape having to punch in, you know, your bass line or whatever. So I have utilized the fact that I can edit things, but it's a very different process, and I've been doing it, you know, longer than I've been a dialogue editor. So it doesn't really feel connected other than that I use the same tool.
Hey, listen, I just see dialogue editor and I'm like, we talked about this last time and I'm like,
Yeah, this album is some sharp lyrics on this record. So, so now this record is out now, and where can people get their hands on this? I know the vinyl is not out yet, right?
No, it's not. It's on available on CD and digital download, and really all I know is go to kittenrobot.com. They do have it there. I'm sure there are other outlets as well. But I know they were in charge and had already been doing some pre-sale on the website. So that's a great place to start.
Yeah, so that link will be right up on our site today. And you guys can just click on that and see what you get. And I always encourage, as I always say, anyone interested in buying an artist's material to go to their site. And this way the middleman gets cut out just a little bit. And I'm all in favor of that. Do you have a potential a date for vinyl on this, Kira?
I don't. From what I understand, pressing vinyl has fell behind like a lot of things during the pandemic. There's been a certain amount of backlogs, and I wanted to go ahead with this. So I think it'll be next year, but I don't know, have a date for it at this time. Again, kittenrobot.com will be the place. But we definitely have discussed it, and if all goes well and we sell a couple of records, that might not hurt.
Right, exactly. It'd be a beautiful thing. Now, let me just ask you briefly, how have you and yours fared during the pandemic out there?
Well, so during the lockdown, obviously, you know, things got here in Los Angeles, things were pretty locked down, which, you know, I love being at home. So I'm one of those lucky few who didn't mind that much. I mean, there was no work for a while. I got to, you know, walk my dogs and I actually worked on producing a record of my friend Glenn Brown's material that I played the bass on. It's the project is called Boss Vagrant, and the record is called Thud. It's on Bandcamp. And so I took on this project as an activity during the lockdown. And then, you know, movies started to get rolling and stuff a little more, and I've been working from home since, you know, fall 2020, and there's been little breaks here and there, but I've gotten a lot of work done from home, and I'm kind of hoping that the working from home thing continues. Our industry hasn't always promoted that because the studios have gear and they have rooms and they're renting that out to the productions, so there's a financial incentive for them not to necessarily have us work from home, but a lot of us who've been doing it, you know, it's sort of like, why do I need to go somewhere to sit in a room by myself and do the editing? I mean, if I'm mixing, if I'm recording ADR, that's different. I go wherever I need to go. So things have started to get rolling again, although there's a pending strike, which may may change things again for a little while. We'll see what happens with that. But like I said, for me personally, the pandemic didn't change my lifestyle that much other than that I didn't have to, you know, go schlep to work every day, which is a positive thing. And more music happened. Although the record we've been listening to was 13 years in the making.
Right.
So it was I always have about 20 songs going in the stage of completion, and, you know, so it works on a continuum, and these songs evolved and Kitten Robot offered to put out my solo record, and I'm 60, so it seemed like a really cool time to do it. But there's other songs, there'll always be more songs, whether or not they ever come out, and so it just offered me a chance to, you know, do what I like to do anyway, which is stay home and work on music and spend time with my dogs and my husband, you know. So I got no complaints about it.
Yeah, that's great. As long as everyone is well.
Of course I care that people were getting sick. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying in terms of lifestyle, my personal lifestyle, I was lucky enough to be able to function alone in my room. I do hope that the economy, you know, recovers and that people get a chance to go back to work and that work improves as a result. You know, maybe there's some hope of something good coming out of it if people are a little more conscious of their work-life balance.
Yeah, I think that's a big factor. I think that lots of companies, lots of corporations, lots of individuals are looking at this thing like, we got the job done anyway, and we were home. And, you know, I think that's a different way to look at things now, that this can be done, and this is an alternate model. And the old model doesn't always hold up. So I think that's a plus.
Yeah. I'm like I said, hopefully something good comes out of it.
Exactly. So the record is out now, and people can get it at kittenrobot.com. That's where I would send all of you. You guys can hit the link right on the playlist page. And tomorrow evening, of course, this podcast will be up, the Finns Revolution podcast. You can just hit the, just Google the thing, Finns Revolution, and you're there. And we'll hear that forever there. But Kira, it's been an absolute pleasure, as always, to speak to you. And, hey, by the way, how's your bass?
My bass is great. I love my bass.
Because you had it. It was missing for a little while, right?
It was stolen. I got it back in 10 days. It was an incredible story. I was, of course, curled up in a ball. I was of no use at all to getting it back. I had some people who cared enough. Actually, someone I work with cared enough to get a former cop involved who sent the picture of the bass around to you know, big chain stores, happened to be Guitar Center. And this guy had seen the picture. When the guy walked in with my bass, he said, you know, I need to take a picture of your driver's license, which is standard procedure when you're selling a guitar. And he goes in the back to Xerox his driver license, and the guy takes off and leaves the bass, and I get it back. I didn't get anything else back that was stolen from
me. All you had to do was show ID of a picture of your hair, probably.
No, actually, it's even better than that. I was at the Northridge Police Department here in Los Angeles, and the guy came out with a bass, and I practically was crying, and he looked at me. He said, I usually try to get proof of ownership, but it's obvious this is your bass. Just by my response at seeing it. So right. It was pretty cool. He got it. He saw my face. He knew what it meant to me, and he handed me the bass.
That is, I love that story, and I'm very happy you have it back. And I'm very happy also for you that it's not like you know, some kind of polka dot base or something. It'd be a lot more hair maintenance involved.
I think that it was interesting that the color blue that I have happens to match the base. It was a complete coincidence.
I'm with you.
Also sometimes go lavender. I'm not just blue. And I love my white hair, too. So, you know, I'm an equal opportunity. But the blue hair did seem to be an interesting tie-in to the bass. It sounds better than any bass I've ever heard, too, which is obviously why it's all over the record. And I lean on it above other basses I own.
It's a beautiful thing, yes. So, Kira, what would you like to hear on our way out? Maybe something from the new record?
Oh, well, if we're putting an ending on it, let's play the last song, In the Quiet.
You got it. That's gorgeous. I love it. And we will hopefully see you live, not too distant future. Hopefully things open up a bit. And hopefully the Dose Project continues in some form or another in the future as well. And looking forward to seeing you, looking forward to hearing you. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much again for having me, Ben. It's always nice to hear your voice.
It's always good to hear you. Thank you, Kira.
Thank you.
best not to say.
Right here on WUSB Stony Brook. Joe V is up next to take us through the wee hours. My name is Finn. Until next week, just remember, don't do anything I wouldn't do. I'll see you.
Top of the-